G'day guys, I've got Tony with me today and I'm Lawrence from Brintac. So we've started a new channel that we're going to add onto our main Brintac channel on YouTube, which is called Now We're Talking. It's revolved around big engines, things with high torque, hence Now We're Talking. A few of the engines that we hope to show you guys that I'm sort of collecting on the side here, and nothing to do with BMWs, some diesels, such as some Detroit two-stroke diesel V8s, and I've already got a Caterpillar V8 diesel engine here, and I've gone and bought myself a C-15 Cat engine, and I've got a radial aircraft engine outside. But this one that you guys probably have already seen pop up here and there on our social is the Rolls-Royce V12 engine. We'll go in to talk about details of this thing shortly, but so this is sort of dedicated for engine stuff, big engine stuff, and we thought we'd start with the V12, and today we're going to rip in and start pulling this thing apart, and as we're doing it we'll talk about it and tell you how I came across it, what its history is, and Tony can talk about some of the history of the engines in general and what he knows. We're both, as you know, engine enthusiasts, so we've got our other little series we do called Engine Autopsy, where we pull things apart, find out why they broke. We'll do one where we're putting engines together, and yeah, this one's dedicated to big engines. So hope you enjoy the video today, guys, and you know, share it around. I'm sure other people who like mechanical stuff and car stuff will appreciate what we're going to show you with this. All right, so what do we got, Tony? Run us through some details of this one. And
all right, Rolls-Royce Meteor is its designation. So it was designed, and it's a derivative of the famous Rolls-Royce Merlin 3 engine.
I tried to get a Merlin engine, but there's not too many around, but I'm not going to give up yet.
No.
I think this is the closest thing. But
Yeah.
Meteor, that's the tank version.
Yes, this is the armoured vehicle version of the famous aircraft engine that powered the Spitfires and Lancasters and Mosquitoes during World War II, and probably some others as well. So it's V12, 60-degree V-angle, 5.4-inch bore, 6-inch stroke. It's 27 litres in capacity. That's in Imperial, it's 1,649 cubic inches. That's pretty big. If you compare a 5-litre engine, which is about 304 cubic inches, 1,649.
So 5 or 6 times bigger in capacity.
Yeah, than a 5-litre engine.
Yep.
Low compression ratio of 6 to 1 to run on all kinds of rubbish fuel they find in the field.
That's 6 to 1. So that's like almost half of what a normal combustion engine would, like 10 to 1.
That's right. An aircraft engine typically runs on a higher octane fuel, but being an armoured vehicle, they just have to, I guess, scrounge around for whatever fuel they could get.
Right.
They used to call it pool fuel, I think, during the war. That was the British.
So it just could be a mix of a bit of diesel with a bit of fuel and kerosene. Okay, yep.
It'll run.
Yeah, right.
600 horsepower at 2,500 RPM, so it's not real high RPM, but you don't need it. Here's the impressive figure, 1,450 pounds of torque.
Wow,
At 1,500 RPM.
Okay, not bad for a petrol engine.
Yeah, that's a
Because diesels are what you need to really pull that sort of torque.
Yeah, that's right, But in those days, a compact, lightweight diesel wasn't as readily available, so I think that's why they used it.
And this is naturally aspirated, this engine, isn't it? So we've got, there's no superchargers on this, there's no turbos on it, and that's the difference between this and the Merlin. The Merlin had a two and well, a first and second stage supercharger.
Then they come out with the two-stage supercharging. So with the two-stage supercharger, with the pilot reached an altitude of about 14,000 feet, so I read, they engaged the second speed to speed the supercharger up, because as the air gets thinner, you need more speed on the supercharger.
That's just keeping the air fuel ratio the same, depending on where the aircraft is.
So that's the key to achieving power at altitude, is more air, because the air's thinner, you still need to get the same amount of air in the cylinder if you're going to produce power. So.
And what power did they make, roughly? I mean, we haven't got the Merlin stuff on that page. But
They were sort of 1,300 to 1,500, but it kept on getting better. And then when the Allison and the Griffin versions came out of that engine, which were derivatives, I think the Griffin was another 10 litres.
Yeah, 37 litre, I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but all from the original design of the Merlin, earlier V12 designs that Rolls-Royce came out.
What was the aircraft before the Lancaster that was a disaster?
The Wellington, yeah.
No, there was another one.
There was a few.
It had a few.
Wellingtons weren't that bad. The
engines kept fusing and melting, overheating, and it was a disaster. The aircraft actually would just fall out of the sky from the engine failure.
I think more pilots died trying to take off in than actually were lost in combat.
So this is the good engine then.
What about the Hansard? Could have been the Hampton, maybe? I can't remember.
Possibly, yeah. Yep. Okay, we'll check. Yeah, we'll have to check that, because we're very interested in why this engine is so reliable and used for so many years in so many Defence Force machinery.
Well, this was developed for the newly being designed, the Chamberlain tank in 41, 42, apparently. That was going to be the main, the new main battle tank that the British Army had at the time. There was a bit of a controversy at the time, not controversy, but there was a choice to be made. The Americans wanted to push they had a Ford V8 engine of about 500 horsepower that was being developed, but it had a lot of teething problems, and so it was designated not suitable for armoured vehicles at the time, whereas this one was already a runner and up and going. And this was jointly designed and developed with Leyland / Rover.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Very much a British design. I heard, actually, that, I don't know if this is true or not, or I read it somewhere, that a lot of takeoffs from the aircraft, because they had to get pilots in quickly and they had to ramp up their production and volume to keep up with the Germans, a lot of them would crash on takeoff because they're just inexperienced. So they'd salvage the engines, but they weren't airworthy again because they'd been in a crash, but still okay. So then they thought, oh, well, let's unbolt the supercharger and the step-up drive for the prop and put it in the tank. And they went, this is too good, and they started just at the production line fending them off for tanks. Is that how it came about? Or?
Some of it, but obviously in a time like that, you've got to be as resourceful as possible.
Yeah.
Use everything you've got.
Yeah.
The other things they were doing were that castings that were production castings that weren't suitable for the aircraft engines were then, but still suitable for a tank, for example, were used.
Okay.
So they'd still be new parts, but deemed unsuitable because there was some flaw that wouldn't pass the aircraft standards.
Okay.
So they would use them in the tank engines.
Well, come in, guys, and have a look. I'm going to quickly explain how I came across this and why it sort of adds a little bit of character to the story. So you can see all this dark brown muck on this engine compared to the valve cover here. This has all been washed off, and that's the original paint. This brown stuff here is like if you have a look, I can scratch that away, and you'll see that it's the same colour paint underneath on everything. And this is like a wax, so it's a preservative wax. And I was told from the seller that I got this from down in Victoria in Australia here, that this was rebuilt by the Defence Force in 1951. So that's 71 years ago this year. So this has been sitting in a preserved wax as a fully reconditioned engine for 71 years, ready to run. And in theory, we should be able to just fire this thing up, in theory. I don't think they meant for it to sit around for 71 years before it was reused, but we've had the valve cover off, and we'll pull it off in a minute and show you what's underneath. This wax, when the engine heats up, or if you were to start it, it starts to melt like a syrup and then becomes an oil.
Well, we're assuming that, because we can't see them carrying out a deep preservation process in the field. If a tank has a failed engine and needs to be recovered in the field, in other words, the engine changed, we can't see them bringing one out of storage, deep preserving in the field.
Well, especially with what we see under here. So why don't we pull this off now and have a look? This stuff here is the same as what's on the outside, but it looks a lot shinier and cleaner because it hasn't been exposed to dust and debris. So therefore, we think there's no way that they would wash this off before running it. So it must just be a preservative that they, under heat, will turn into a runny liquid and become a lubricant.
That's right. It'll homogenise with the oil and just run.
But part of the journey on this is we're going to pull it apart. So we assume it's ready to run. But we're going to pull it down. We're going to go through all the parts. We're going to measure, check, and learn, and enjoy, and do all the things that you should do if you've got one of these engines at your access. So today
we're concerned about perishable parts. After 71 years, for example, there's probably some rubber rings at the bottom seal on the liners, for example.
Oh yeah, yep.
It's no good if they're cracked, and we put water in it, and we get filling the sump up with water and. Or coolant, I should say.
You could do some serious
damage.
And
obviously all this external, all these perishable rubber parts on the outside here, we've got to look at all that as well.
Well, all this cloth, we might even find, if we were to pull this off, there might be an old newspaper that's dated from, there is some sort of newspaper here. We might try and read that.
Horse racing. Oh, yeah, it's in pounds. There's some pound on it.
Yeah. Like 1942, what happened in 1942? We can read about that.
Probably later, but we'll have a look. It's going to be pretty interesting once we do start to get it apart, because this engine, unlike most modern engines, has the old terms are used here for real. We have a crankcase where the crank is. We have a cylinder block where the cylinders are, and they're separate components, whereas all modern engines, this is all cast to integral as one piece. So the cylinder case comes off separately to the crankcase. Each cylinder head is one piece and it comes off. The connecting rods in this engine are a fork and blade arrangement, and we'll show you that once we get to that stage later on in a subsequent video. And that's a really interesting design as well. So I've worked on engines with fork and blade design before, so I'll explain the principle behind that as well. Once we get the valley off here, we're able to see the two huge updraft carburetors that apparently are sitting under here. I want to see the size of the butterflies on these.
There's definitely something there, yeah. So I think this is pretty complete.
Both dual throat carbies, and I'm expecting to see sort of 2 or 3 inch butterflies in there as well. So that's going to be something interesting too. Oh, another interesting point here. Have a look here, Magneto. So this uses basically the exact ignition system as the aircraft version. We've got two magnetos driven off the free end of the engine here. This is the water pump at this end. Each magneto drives a separate set of plugs. So this magneto drives the exhaust side plugs, and you can see this this hose here is feeding to the other bank, and then it tees off here and flows up here. These are the spark plug leads here. So these are firing all of the exhaust side spark plugs. There's two spark plugs per cylinder, one on the inlet side, one on the exhaust. The other magneto feeds the inlet spark plugs, and you can see this is the protective sleeving up here, and the other one's teeing off here and going to the other bank there, and that's feeding the inlet spark plugs. So two plugs per cylinder, and they don't fire simultaneously. There is a staggering, there's an offset of the firing. So we're going to learn about that and find out, you know, all about the reasoning for that. I'm assuming that, you know, most aircraft needing redundancy, being based on an aircraft engine, you need some redundancy there. So if you've got one plug failing, at least you've got another one firing, so that cylinder's still firing. That could be the reason why. But we'll do some more research and check that out as well later on. When Lawrence bought the engine, it came on this rotator, which is great. We'll be able to, you know, rotate it around and work on it easily once we start to strip it down further. We don't have an effective rotating mechanism on it yet. Someone has started to do a bit of design work here. What we're going to do is buy and install a worm drive mechanism here so that we can just wind it over slowly with a worm drive. And the other benefit of that is it's much safer. It doesn't matter what orientation the engine's in, it won't self-rotate and do some damage or hurt someone. So you'll see that fitted later on as well. We'll fit it on the rotator here as well to make that safe. This preservative, I've used it before in my past days that I've used. It's more or less a solid at room temperature. You've actually got to heat it to get it to run or spray. And the product that I used before was called Tectal, and it was something made by Valvoline. It could be Tectal or an equivalent product, but that's what I used to use. Normally, automotive engines are addressed out from the free end, but I know that industrial engines, you address from the drive end, and you typically use an A bank or A side and a B side or a B bank, and then the numbers are numbered consecutively from that drive end. So if you look down inside here, you'll see, and there's a drive, and also at this end as well. Now, in an armoured vehicle, I would assume that one end's driving to the transmission, and the other end's probably driving a hydraulic pump for the hydraulic requirement on board. I don't know whether the turret operation was electric or hydraulic back in these particular vehicles. Not sure.
I've got a starter motor in a box over here, and when I look at the drive nose of this, it looks like it matches that end down there. So that's probably where the starter motor. Yep. So this must be the transmission or the genset drive or whatever, however it was powered. Were these powered mechanically or were they powering an electric motor?
Mechanical.
Mechanical. Yeah, mechanical. Okay.
So, well, we'll call this one here A side here, and we'll call this side B side. Okay, so this is our drive side, and we'll just refer to the cylinders as they're going up there. You can see a heap of reference numbers that have been stamped in this cylinder head here. We don't know the background. We didn't get the logbook, unfortunately, with the engine, which would have shown apparently the maintenance history of the engine, and that would have been really interesting to see. But doesn't matter. We think we've got just about a complete engine. And if we haven't, or we need some parts, I'm pretty sure we'll be able to find someone somewhere that can help out.
Hopefully.
There was a lot of these produced, apparently. They produced this engine in Britain up until 1964. So it was started in 41 to 64. So I think there would be quite a few around, and I'm sure there's some enthusiasts that would be interested in be able to help.
Well, yeah. Anyone who knows about these engines or has parts or wants to join us on the adventure, in the comments, send us a message, however you like to reach out, we'll be all ears. Let's put one of these covers off and have a look and see what's underneath. So I've just taken, they're all held on with some tubes and nuts. It's obviously just rough and ready for general protection, but I've taken those off. And yeah, it's just a, it looks like it's an exhaust port with two chambers. It's just full of that same wax.
Well, it's a four valve cylinder head, so it's pretty much like our modern twin cam per cylinder sort of engines. You can see that from the rocker gear.
Yeah, right. So here's our two exhaust valves. Mm-hmm. So it's a four valve per cylinder overhead cam.
Yeah, single cam running, hitting on the rocker, which is opening the valves via the rocker arm. It is an interesting design feature. You don't see it these days much, but the camshaft's driven on a bevel drive gear. So if you move down there, you'll just see that how the bevel gear is driving the camshaft gear through this angle. So you're changing the direction of drive from vertical up in that direction to this direction to rotate the camshaft.
So instead of running a chain around a sprocket in a modern engine or a timing belt, it's actually got a mechanical shaft with a bevel gear here. So there must be something at the other end running off a primary gear off the crank, I'm assuming. It runs both these shafts.
Yeah, that'll be good to see that too when we get there.
Okay.
Here's another thing that's typical that I'm really impressed with when you see old engines, like all these, what they call castle nuts. You can see they're all castle-shaped at the top. There's a split pin through there, each one of them, to stop them coming loose on their own through vibration and harmonics. So there's castle nuts everywhere through this engine. You never see that on modern engines.
No. So the time alone just to get one of these engines apart and together is the appreciation of what this thing is It's amazing how they did them so many so quickly in the time for the war, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the amount of hard work just to make this before you even go into battle. So it's the war effort,
the war industry, they call it.
You can see where that comes from.
Yeah. And it's famous. The Rolls-Royce name is famous. You know, it's funny. We do a lot of BMW work. Rolls-Royce is owned now. The car business is owned by BMW. There's several different divisions of Rolls-Royce, but it's just a coincidence that this, we come across with a Rolls-Royce engine.
Oh, well, it fits in here well then, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right, well, shall we start pulling some bits off it? This is going to be a big job. I think we're going to be quite a few episodes in just pulling this thing apart. So I've peeled off a bit of that newspaper that we happened to find, and it's got 1975 at the top there, which is interesting. So, you know, maybe this thing has been moved around and had a few different goes of having covers put on the intakes. Who knows, but that might have to go into a little frame and be hung up on the wall behind it. Olympic Park dogs tonight. I'd say those dogs are long gone.
So, Lawrence is going to strip some bits off here. We're just trying to keep it a little bit tidy and clean. I'll just slip this rocker cover back on. Just notice the wear of the paint on the top of the cover here. You can see it down to the aluminium and the paint's come off. I would say that this is it's been used as a tread plate, basically. So it's been walked on and the paint's come off with boot wear, actually. Because I can imagine being in the vehicle, in the tank, with the engine hatch open, and they would be working in here and actually standing on the cover.
Okay, so straddling the engine, just walking across it.
Because it would have been a lot of ancillary pipe work and stuff to do in here to connect and work on and electrical things. And that's what's taken the paint off. And I think that bit of newspaper, Lawrence, 75.
Yep.
So when things are put into storage and are preserved, then they're re-inspected from time to time to check the state of preservation.
Okay, yep.
So they probably would have taken that apart there and just checked for, say, moisture or anything in there and then resealed it, you know, with a current bit of newspaper.
That makes sense, because 1975 is way past reconditioning this for any reason, isn't it? Except for what we're doing today, which is rat rotting or hot rotting or stupid things like, you know, a few people, don't you, actually? Or one person in particular who's got these running.
I did meet someone recently at a race meeting and he apparently has got a lot of Merlin maintenance manuals and overhaul manuals. He was an ex-RAAF mechanic. He did his apprenticeship in the Air Force, I think in the late 50s. And so we might get in contact with him and
See if you can come over and bring some...
We might see him in the next video or something like that. Yep.
And what about as far as people in the world with these running in some sort of car?
Oh,
there's one person in particular that's got a good example.
There's a brilliant car enthusiast in California. He's got quite a collection. And he's got a Meteor in a pre-war Bentley, I believe.
And yeah, I think so.
He's also got a Merlin in a pre-war Rolls-Royce, I think. I might have that wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So that's a pretty impressive sort of a garage. When you're a Rolls-Royce Merlin enthusiast, as he is, that's an impressive garage sort of a collection to have one of each.
Oh, well, I don't think I'll ever get there, but, you know, it's certainly a bit of inspiration to make this thing go in something one day.
Oh, it was impressive to see it in the vehicle and thinking it fits in the
It's a scale vehicle, isn't it? Like, the engine's to scale to the chassis
A big car. They're a full-frame car. Yeah. You know, they're quite a big vehicle. And then to see it actually, how they've engineered it to get it in there and it still fits in there. And once all the covers are on, you wouldn't know what's in there, really. There's one of these monsters in there.
Well, something to aspire to, I think.
Yeah.
It looks pretty clean in there still. Nice shiny metal and no debris. So it's done its job. Looks like a bit of some original engine oil in there. So this is a... What have we got here? So we've got some sort of oil accumulator system going on here, or is this a filter, or what do you think this is? It looks like a filter arrangement.
Yeah, because of maintenance issues, because in the vehicle you need something accessible easily to service with. So from the bottom you're going to drain, and from the top you'll be able to service the filter.
So if we undo these five bolts here, this cap looks like it comes off, and there could be a cartridge in there or something.
That's quite a heavy, large component. As you can understand, you can hear the brushes. Inside. Anyway, that would have gone away. That's heavy.
Sounds tip top. What do you think that weighs, Tony? 20 or 30. There we go. If you guys go over and have a look on the wall there of that car on that calendar, please, Mr. Camera Person. Now, that's obviously the newest Ford GT, which is a pretty cool car. But if we go back to the original Ford GT in the 60s, the one that the British built, and... GT40. Of course.
The 40 refers to the roof line height.
40 inches off the ground of the roof, one of the lowest cars at the time, I think. So, old Ken Miles from Britain, who was known for being able to finish a race and get a car home, was apparently a tank driver in World War II and landed on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day and drove the tank that he arrived on the beachfront in and drove it all the way to Germany. So definitely known for finishing a race.
We think. That's the story. Yeah.
That's the story. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
We'll confirm or deny it in the future.
Look, let's look it up, guys. It could be true, but it's a pretty good story. Drove one of these engines in a tank from Normandy beaches to Berlin and then came home and won Le Mans in one of those on the wall. Not that one, but yeah, pretty cool. So I'm about to crack open this oil filter housing. Should we have a look inside it?
Yeah.
Might need some help with it. I just have to go backwards a little bit to get to this bottom.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe I can stand it up. Can we stand it up on the end there?
It would have been better to leave it clamped and then take it.
I couldn't get to that.
Oh, okay.
That bolt's in the way of the valve cover.
I'll stand it. Is that one still tight?
It should just lift up. Yep. Just a bit of wax holding it down. Is it tight? Yes. It's not that tight, though.
Okay. You'll be able to...
Maybe that's not that one. Yeah, that's it.
Oops. It's been a double coil split.
Oh, there's two.
Spring washer.
Oh, double coil. Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. It's not something I've ever seen before.
Yeah. It's two coils, split spring washer. I'm losing it.
Well, don't lose it. It'll put a hole in the floor, that, if you drop it. Looks like a bomb. Is it? Should we open it?
Oh, I've got another one here. Okay. Camouflage between the fittings.
Oh, yeah. I think it's loose. Yeah, I got that one.
This ring's coming down.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, yep. Mm. That's floating up on its own. There's a spring pushing that up.
Yeah, that's definitely an oil filter.
That's full of oil, too.
There you go. We should get an analysis done.
Wow. Do you reckon there's any copper in this one?
That might. The lid's coming sort of. Yeah, that's it. If you just reel that off, they're locked up.
That's heavy.
Yep.
That's about 10 kilos, I reckon.
Solid stuff. All right, I've got a cover on it.
That is heavy. That's full of oil.
Is it?
Yeah.
Do you want to put it in a container? Oh, there's a spring attached to it.
Big spring on the bottom.
Yeah.
Let's just leave it in there and we'll sit it upright and that'll obviously need a little clean later.
Yeah.
But that's.
It's pretty good.
That's just, it feels good.
Yeah.
Bit of fuel in it.
Oh, that's an old oil smell to me. That's how it was when I was younger. Smell like that.
Maybe it ran on this stuff, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
I noticed that all the hose clamps on these have got round heads, so you can't go throwing a socket on it.
Yeah.
You know,
it must have been an innovation that came later.
Yeah. So this has a cap on the end of it, and it's another seated fitting. Do you think this is an extension of where they would run? Something must have gone off here because it's not terminated.
Well, I've got the connection, same pipe work here, down into this housing here. Now, I'm thinking that this is a water, part of a water manifold here, and this is the water outlet to the radiator. So it's possibly an air bleed.
Okay. I'll leave that on there for the moment and we'll follow that.
Because it's water coming out of the cylinder head, and it's high up on that housing.
That's the highest point, really, isn't it, of the whole system?
Yeah, so it could have been an air bleed.
Okay.
Yeah. So, these are both our air intakes here, and that's the water outlet for the radiator. And we've got water coming back in from the radiator into the pump here. And then it's flowing into the centre of the impeller, and then it flings it out. That's a centrifugal pump. And then it's being fed out here and here. And then down this pipework along the outside of the crankcase and then into the cylinder case here. You can see there's a connection there and there and there. And there's the three entry ports there on this side where the coolant's flowing into the cylinder case. And then from the cylinder case up around the cylinders into the cylinder head and then flowing back out through that manifold where that air bleed line is, finding its way forward and coming out there. And there's another connection at the front. That's probably the thermostat. We'll try and see if we can get some schematic drawings of the circuit. Some engines you can get that with, where they show, for example, this is the coolant circuit, and it gives you a cutaway of the engine, and you know it'll be coloured where the coolant flows. Same with the oil circuit, same with the fuel, that sort of thing. We'll see what we can find.
Well, if
it's not a Meteor, a Merlin's going to be probably close enough because it's based on the same design. We'll have a look at that and see what we can find.
Yeah, so please, anyone that's got tech drawings or anything that could help, we'll be more than happy to receive it. So send them through. Actually, I watched some videos on that vintage V12. Is that what it's called? Vintage V12 in America. And is his name Jose?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this bloke, little ponytail.
He's a customer.
Yeah. He's a pilot of some sort, customer. He goes in. And without exaggerating, and you guys should look it up yourself, there's a few videos on YouTube called Vintage V12. There would have been at least 80 blocks sitting up on the racking. There was dozens of engines together, dozens being pulled apart. I don't know how.
It's V12 heaven there.
Yep. It's just this little shed in the middle of the desert. No security. Everyone knows it's there. It just seems to be.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. But geez, what a gold mine of a place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I have a thing personally about V12 engines that I sort of, they're a big favourite of mine. Just because of the way they run, they just run so smoothly. It's just like a sewing machine, the way they run. Because I spent a lot of time working on V12s and V16s in the old days, in my marine days at MTU. So,
well, there's a couple of V16 MTU engines on greys at the moment. Those ones I was telling you about.
Yeah. They're a newer generation. I worked on the older generations that were part of the Mybac heritage. Because MTU was originally the Mybac engine factory, or the Mybac Motorenbau. So this was a family business.
This is a late 1800s, early 1900s.
Well, the father, Wilhelm Mybac, the founder of the company, he goes back into the 1800s as far as his development goes and engineering work. And then his son Carl took over. And so it was a multi-generational success story as far as German engine technology goes, so... And funny enough, all of the main battle tanks on the other side of the firing line were usually powered with Mybac engines.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Another. We're only interested in the technical side, really, not the conflict. But yeah, the Mybac stuff was on the other side. So the Tigers and the Panthers and all those kinds of things, the half tracks. Here's an interesting story, right? I got a really interesting. Can you hear me? Tell you a story. I'm a little bit into historic racing, as you know.
Yep.
And so during the Second World War, the Australian Imperial Force were sent to North Africa to help the British fight the Italians and the / Germans once they reinforced the Italians. And through the battles in North Africa, the Australians managed to capture some of the German hardware. And they sent some of it back to Australia for a technical analysis to determine whether it could be useful or, you know, technically beneficial if we adopt some of the technologies that they discovered. And I assume it was three of those half-track German vehicles. So you've got a Caterpillar type track on the rear of the vehicle and normal road tyres on the front.
Yep.
They were powered with a Mybac engine. It was the HL42, which was an inline 4.2-litre six-cylinder petrol engine, single overhead cam, aluminium cylinder head. Pretty advanced for its time, really.
Yeah.
And a good, reliable, sturdy engine. The analysis was done, and they said, yeah, this is good. I don't know the whole story. I'm just sort of assuming. And they were put away for storage. Nothing was really done about it at the time. After the war, somehow... some of it, you might know the name Phil Irving, or you could research it. He was an Australian engineer heavily involved in motorsport. Pulled these engines out that were in storage. I think he was working for Repco at the time, because Repco was in quite a lot of cooperation with Brabham, the Brabham team at the time, developing engines. But this was well before that, I think. This was in the early 50s. So late 40s, early 50s. And Irving had a look at these engines, apparently, and probably some of his associates, and they said, these engines look really good. Let's build some chassis and build some race cars. So they built three race cars with the three engines they had.
Right.
Now, two of those cars still survive today. I think the other one was lost in an accident. And so they're the Mybac Specials. And they have the original company logo on the front of the grille of the race car. So it's two M's. There's a wide M, and sitting over that's a tall M. So it's the two M's.
Yep, yep.
And you might have seen them.
I've seen that Mercedes logo.
The logo. You'll see it on the current, you know, or modern day Mercedes cars, which is the top of the line, Uber level of an S-Class, if you know what I mean.
So yep,
yeah,
yep.
Get that. Well, there's a heritage there with Mercedes-Benz as well, but that's another story.
Okay.
Anyway, so... the MM stands for, in the German terminology, is Mybach, which is the family name, and Motorenbau. So motor, Bau, it's two words. Germans can join lots of words together, and it's allowed in their language.
Okay.
So it means the engine factory, if you like, or engine building. Bau is to assemble or build.
Okay.
And Motor is motor. So in English, we're a little bit more detailed in our language. We're pretty lucky in English. We have a very detailed vocabulary. We can describe... things in detail better than any other language, apparently. Almost twice as much detail as the Germans, and everybody thinks German language is a very technical language. But we can do a little bit better as far as description goes.
So we have multiple words for the
same
meaning.
Well, we have a word for motor, context. And we have a word for engine.
discriminate. There is a difference.
Yes.
Most people don't discriminate.
I discriminate the two. Motor electric engine is combustion engine.
A motor in English is something that's driven by non-combustible fuel. Hydraulic, pneumatic, electric.
Yep.
An engine is something that's powered by a combustible fuel.
Yep.
But it's not limited to internal combustion. It can be external combustion as well. So therefore, a steam engine is an engine.
An engine.
Yeah. It's external combustion, but it's still an engine. But that's where the name Motorenbauer, because motor in German means both types. They don't have a word for engine. They just have the word motor. So two of those cars still survive today. And one was owned for and restored by John Shepherd, who was the Holden dealer team manager during the late 70s, during those A9X eras, once they sort of hit that late era during that point. And the other is owned by Bob Harborough. And those cars turn up occasionally at the historic race meetings, particularly at Phillip Island. And it's fantastic to see them there. And that's an Australian innovation design. Now, that car won the 1953 New Zealand Grand Prix in the hands of Stan Jones, Alan Jones's father.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yep.
There's a little bit of trivia.
Right.
There's some trivia.
Well, I just found an interesting little part of this engine, which is probably the most exciting part. Is this the throttle linkage?
Yes, it's the go lever.
Right.
That's the go lever. So there would have been a mechanical link to the driver from there.
Looking forward to the day that we can do a bit of that. See what happens.
Make some noise.
Yeah. Yeah, so with the incentive with this series that we're doing now, we're talking is all these engines, we're going to run them on stands or get them to a running state and at least run them on an engine stand so we can hear them and experience them. And then if time allows, which is always a hard thing, but it'd be nice to put it in some sort of chassis and make it go.
Yeah, use it as motive power for something would be really good to see, but as you said, historically they're significant and they're interesting, so that's why we're fiddling with them, because we're engine enthusiasts and we always like to learn about new things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And old things.
Well, yeah, this is very old, but I think it's still a modern engine when you look at the specs.
Well, advanced for its time, that's for sure, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's the outlet, and that's a big thermostat. So that would be the same as what you would see in a normal car, but just a lot bigger. It's actually got a coil through there. But the heat must activate the plunger inside.
Up. Oh. Jesus, that's it.
Okay, just sit it on the valve gear gently. That's legitimately the first attempt of pulling that out, so we weren't talking because we thought it wouldn't work. All right. You right?
I'll get down. Yep. Right out.
Okay. Come around here, guys, and have a look at this. We'll just sit it down, maybe turn it onto its side this way.
Yep.
That's another spark plug.
A washer, yeah.
Washer. So this is the intake manifold system, and that's got the carburetors at the end. These were the intake tubes that you saw me popping off before that were on here, so that's the air going in. And then, Tony, what happens after that?
Yeah, these butterflies are basically the air restrictors into the carburetor, so the carburetor must be just, there's no... Let's just have a look. Yeah, so that's the throttle linkage there. That could be a choke linkage up the top there for a choke, I'm not sure, or an accelerator pump set up there as well. So we still have to work that out. So air's coming in into the manifold in the valley. This assembly fills up the valley pretty much completely, and then flows up through these dual throat carburetors here. You can get an idea of the size of the butterflies that we're going to see inside here when we get that apart. And then up into the inlet manifold, and then it's just distributed down here, this part of the manifold here, and then down into the cylinder head. So if we...
British made.
Zenith, there's Zenith carburetors, and that must be the designated model, 56DC. And then, so it flows up into here. And then...
So now's a good time to have a look in the valley of this engine. You can actually see the cylinder shapes, the 12 cylinders. that tight 60-degree V-shape that Tony mentioned earlier. A couple of missing nuts down here that have probably been there for 70 years. That's good.
Fair bit of debris. And then this is where the inlet mix is flowing down into this other sort of a shallow manifold here, which is bolted onto the cylinder head, and then it'll distribute into the ports, past the valves, into the cylinders. It's quite a narrow slot, isn't it, really, when you think about it?
Very narrow.
Cross-section's probably quite good, but, yeah, all compact. Has to be compact, has to be purpose designed to maximise the space available.
So this has been, swing around here and have a look, this has been probably, what, 3 hours of hand-tooling all these nuts off one by one, and they've all been...
It's the preservative that's made it...
Open-end spanner, yeah. 1/8 of a turn at a time, and yeah. Sticky, and it's been a very long process, so... now we're sort of getting up to the exciting bit. I think we've...
It's a tank.
Oh, yeah?
It's a tank. There's a rock.
Yeah, a bit of shrapnel. Now we'll actually be able to start undressing this thing quite quickly. So it may not be the next episode we do here on Now We're Talking, because we do want to try and cover off and introduce a number of those engines we mentioned at the beginning. So, you know, a couple of Cat diesel engines, the Detroit two-stroke diesel engine...
That's Continental radial aircraft engine.
Continental,
that's
yep.
Interesting.
Yep, that's a World War II trainer engine. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get that up on a stand and hopefully bring that in and start having a look at that. So we might sort of pick on a few of these engines and introduce them and do a little bit of this on each to try and get them all moving along and keep a bit of variety going. But when we do get to the next episode of this, this should fly apart quite quickly. You know, valve gear off, some heads off, start seeing some pistons.
I want it to last. I want the experience to be, something to memorize.
Well, then we get to wash it all up, and then it'll all be laid out, and how exciting will that be?
Oh, yeah. Once it's all clean, you'll be able to see it.
So you've just handed me a spark plug that you've pulled out of this thing.
Yeah, well, no, it's
not a spark plug. I didn't think so.
It looks like a spark plug, but it's not. No.
So, I'll show you a what is it? It's a get a real spark plug. And so this is just a little plastic dummy spark plug that follows the same profile and thread, and it's actually full of little moisture beads.
Little desiccant crystals, yeah. So part of the preservation process, not apart from this this heavy, tacky preservation grease that they sprayed it all with, they put these in the inside the valley on the inlet side of the engine, and it's a little cylinder full of crystal, and that's a desiccant, and there's like a little scented bronze filter in here, and it's just plastic with a rubber gasket on it, and that screws into the spark plug hole. Now, that's being the top of the cylinder, top of the combustion area. So any moisture that would form in there would tend to go to the top and then be absorbed. It'll actually draw it up and absorb it. It possibly changes colour. This crystal might change colour. It might have been like a more white colour when it was dry. And it's got a spring clip on it. So I'd say you take it apart. You can dry out the crystal, get the moisture out, put it back in, and then reinstall it.
Okay.
As your desiccant. Part of the preservation process. Long-term storage.
So we're very lucky with this engine. It has been preserved properly and it's all looking really good. Everything's come apart, although tedious and time-consuming. Nothing's been seized or corroded or stubborn. It's all come apart quite well, hasn't it?
Yeah, so far so good, yeah.
Yep. All right, well, there's one last look of it as it sits after today's effort. Hopefully we can come back to it pretty quickly and you guys will get to see the whole experience with us on this one. And thanks, Tony, for pushing me to get this thing out on screen, because it's been sitting here for a little while and we've been hinting and talking about it and showing it off, but now it's actually becoming real. So
it's great to touch it. You know, it's part of history and, the engine world, and everyone knows the name Rolls-Royce, and this is strongly related, very closely related to the famous Merlin, so, this is the same design. So.
Yep. All right, there you have it, guys. So hopefully you're enjoying our new series, and keep tuned and stay subscribed to our Brintech channel and watch some engines come apart and go together. And we'll just keep it exciting and try and keep it regular. Yeah. Take it easy. Thanks for watching.